نخلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. We begin this morning with a long look at Palestine's premier institution of higher learning, Birzeit University. Palestinians are among the highest educated people on the face of the earth. That is the good news. The bad news is that after they get their many degrees, whether it be a BA or a master's degree or a PhD or whatever, there are few jobs and extremely limited opportunities in their field for them when they finish. However, despite the grim economic and career opportunities, Palestinians highly value education, and families go to extraordinary sacrifices to educate their children. It's an amazing phenomenon for a country living under military occupation. And Birzeit University? It is rated in the top 3% of universities in the world. How's that for an amazing statistic? Here is the president of Birzeit, Dr. Abdulatif Abuhilya, tell us about the university and the vital role it plays in Palestinian society. He speaks at the Palestine Center in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Mohammed. I'm glad to be here again. Thank you, Mr. Rabi, for inviting me to talk about the education in general in Palestine and specifically in Birzeit University. I will say that Birzeit University is the leading institution of the higher education in Palestine. I will give a short history of the university. When it started as elementary school in 1924, it was established by a lady called Nabiha Nasser from the town of Birzeit, and she established this elementary school for girls at that time in 1924. And a lot of Palestinians used to come actually to Birzeit school. George, now he reminded me that he got some education in Birzeit school, not a university, I mean, in maybe, I don't know, in the 40s or 50s. In the 30s, and yeah, then this school, I mean, developed into a college in the 50s and the 60s, and this college used to offer, after, you know, it was upgraded to a college, it used to offer 2 years education to Palestinians and some of the Arabs from the Gulf area, from Jordan, from Syria. Lebanon used to come and get some education 2 years in this 2 years college. They used to call it Birzeit College, actually. This is in the 50s and during the 50s and the 60s. After the occupation of the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, the people who were the founders, actually, of Birzeit School and Birzeit College, they start thinking that why the young men and women of Palestinians should go abroad and get their degrees from outside. We want to keep these kids inside the country. Maybe we, as a Palestinian, we learned our lesson not to leave home after 1948. And this is one of the good lessons we learned. And I will tell you now, the population of the Palestinians inside the historical Palestine is 6.6 million. I mean, more than half of the Palestinians are still living in Palestine. Yes, it is 6.6 million, including, I mean, the inhabitants of the West Bank, in the Gaza, and the Palestinians inside Israel. This is 6.6. Just for comparison, for not for anything else, the Jews, which we don't like to classify people, Muslims, Jews, Christians, but anyway, inside historical Palestine, it's also 6.5 to 6.6, which means now the Palestinians and the Israel or the Jews actually 50-50 inside Palestine. Yes, and this is one of the important, I believe myself, that the universities, which Birzeit played a tremendous role in keeping the Palestinian people and especially the young Palestinians inside Palestine by offering the higher education in the university. The Birzeit turned or upgraded to a university in 1972 after the occupation of the West Bank in 1967. Before that, I mean, those students who graduated from Birzeit College having these 2 years of education used to go to the American University in Beirut and get their bachelor degree in whatever area. Some of you maybe know that. And we still have a good relationship with the American University in Beirut. Then Birzeit became a university in 1972. And since then, it developed into, I would say now, to a comprehensive university. Almost we have more than 100 programs. We offer bachelor degrees in about 75 bachelor degree programs. We have about 35 master's programs in different area, and we only have one PhD program, which is in social sciences. But the undergraduate programs, as I said, generally we offer bachelors in different areas. It's a comprehensive university, except medicine. We don't have school of medicine or a faculty of medicine yet, but we have other things. I mean, we have PharmD, we have nursing, we have nutrition, of course, science, engineering, whatever. And now we have our student body is about 14,000. It is not the largest university in the West Bank and Gaza or in Palestine. It is the oldest and the first Palestinian university. We are proud that our international ranking, this is lately in the last 2 years, put us as one of the top 3% of the universities around the world. I mean, this ranking is, yes, we are one of the top 3% out of, 26,000 universities they ranked around the world. It's Birzeit, people look at it as, you know, really is the leading institution in the West Bank in terms of educating people. And we have over 38,000 graduates now, graduated from Birzeit University. They are spread all over the world. And we are proud of our graduates. Many of the leaders of the Palestinian authorities are graduates of Birzeit University. We have, during these years where university developed into a comprehensive university, we received a lot of support. I mean financially and other supports from our friends inside and outside Palestine. I'll give you just, I don't have a picture of the campus or photos, but we have brochures. I don't know if we can distribute them. This is one, I mean, this is part of the campus Bir Zeit has. It's a very nice campus. We almost have about 30 buildings. I'm proud to say that these 30 buildings are donated by the Palestinians in diaspora and from inside. And, I mean, each building costs not less than $3 million, I mean, which means an individual Palestinian, like the latest, the one who is building the last faculty or the recent faculty we are having is the Faculty of Arts, Music and Design. And the building is donated for over $3 million. Is donated by Samira Weda, who is from Jerusalem, actually, originally. And he's a businessman in the Gulf area in Dubai. And he donated this over $3 million to build this building. And the building we inaugurated recently, one of the buildings, is the building for the law and public administration, is also donated by Palestinians. His name is Riyad Sadiq, for over $4 million. And so on. We have a faculty of engineering, which has all kind of engineering degrees. It's been donated by Sheikh Omar Al-Aqqad. He is a Palestinian from Java, and he donated over $5 million in the 80s, actually. This school of engineering has been built in 1979-1980. And it was donated by one Palestinian, his name is School of Engineering, Omar Al-Aqqad School of Engineering, is one Palestinian at that time, donated over $5 million to build this Faculty of Engineering. The reason that people, they believe really in Bir Zeit University, that this is the leading institutions of the higher education, and they took this lead, and it really played and still playing an essential role in the Palestinian society. We have 9 faculties, as I said, except medicine. But in addition to the 9 faculties, we have 11 centers and institutions, center and institutes. And these centers and institutes, they are serving the community. I mean, this is one of our main mission, is to keep in touch with the Palestinian community, serve them, help them, and in many aspects. For example, we have a center of health education. This center do a lot of research related to the health of the Palestinians inside Palestine and outside Palestine. And every year we held a conference in Bir Zeit or outside Bir Zeit. Last year we held a conference in the American University in Beirut. And the main topic of the institute was, we were talking about the health of the Palestinian inside the West Bank and in Lebanon, for example. Yes, we do have communications with other Palestinian brothers in Lebanon, in Jordan, and so on. Bir Zeit has, we are not isolated, actually, from the international community. We have a lot of programs in coordination with the mainly European universities, I would say. Because in Europe, they have so many programs, higher education programs. One of them, they call it Erasmus Plus. Erasmus Plus, this is a European program that European universities can have, they can build a graduate or undergraduate program with universities in the Middle East, that Birzeit can join with the University of Jordan, with the University of, for example, of Rome or whatever. These three universities, for example, they can have mobility of the students in and out from Palestine, which is very important for us, that our students, they have to go outside Palestine or, and to see how other universities functionings. And we would like, I mean, we receive also an academicians from Europe. I mean, they can come and spend a few weeks or a month or so on. I mean, we have some connections. Most of our communication and connections in terms of higher education is with Europe. As a Birzeit University, we try to have a consortium, actually. We did have one, and it is not very active. We need to activate it, where Birzeit is a part of a consortium with American University in Beirut, American University in Cairo, and American University of in Sharjah, I think, and University of California at Davis. Yes, we have this consortium, and we meet every 1 or 2 years. One of the projects we are having related to environment and energy. And actually, it's been supported by a Palestinians in Dubai. I mean, this consortium and the research we are doing together is being supported by a Palestinian who is a businessman also in the Gulf area. In addition to the, as I said, to these faculties we are having and centers and institutions, we at Birzeit University took, offered the Palestinian Authority 20 acres of land and to build a technopark. A technopark, it's a science park where young Palestinians from Birzeit and other Palestinian universities can come and do their, it's an innovation center, and it's a center for these youngs that they can start ups, they can start their own companies. We want to connect them. I mean, the idea is to connect the academia with the market, with the business, and with the industry. This is the science park, which is being donated by the Indians, actually. The Indians donated $12 million for the Palestinian Authority, actually, to build this science park. But the Palestinian Authority, they says Birzeit is the one who is qualified to run this science park. And actually, the president of the Birzeit University is the chairman of the board of this science park. And we are building now. We did not start yet, I mean, functionings, but almost we finished from the buildings. And this is another thing we are doing for our society. I don't know. I think I give you this is a brief information about the university. Of course, I mean, let me mention this. This is important. I mean, Birzeit campus has been closed 15 times by the Israeli military. The latest or the longest closure was during the first intifada from 1988 to 1992. The campus was completely closed by the Israelis during these 4 years. We have to move next to Birzeit town. There is the city is Ramallah. And we have to move to Ramallah, and we rented houses, apartments. We used to teach in our apartments, in our homes, and so on for 4 years, just to continue. Yes, we were not allowed to enter the campus. The campus was completely closed. This is the longest. Of course, during these closures, they used to close it for 2 months, 3 months, and so on, and we open again, and so on. But this was the largest one. Now we have some of our faculty members are, some of them they are Palestinian origins. They hold, many of them, an American passports. They used to come to Birzeit, I mean, and we offer them a contract for 1 year, and they take, they usually take this contract and show it to the civil, they call it civil administration of the Israeli civil administration, and they used to give them a 1 year visa to stay, because they have to. In the last year, actually, some of them, they start, actually, they deny renewal of some of these visas to some of these faculty members. And seven of them now are almost, are going maybe to leave if the Israelis will not renew their entry visas. And this is one of the difficulties we are facing, you know. Internationalization these days is very important for the faculty members and for students. And this is one of the things we want to bring, not only the Palestinians in diaspora, no, we want to bring our colleagues and academics from United States, from Europe, and from everywhere, because we have to be part of the international community. And this is one of the main mission of the, any university, is to be part of the academic life of the universities around the world. I mean, cooperation between universities are essential for all. I mean, for students, for faculties, for the society, and so on.
That was Dr. Abdulatif Abu Hilya, president of Birzeit University, speaking in Washington, D.C. And now for something completely different. Our next presentation explores the early development of the relationship between the CIA and the Israeli Mossad. Jefferson Morley speaks about his research, which led to a book on James Angleton, who was the key person early on in the creation of the CIA and the person most responsible in forging the close ties between the intelligence forces in the U.S. and Israel. This is quite a story, so hang on. Here is investigative reporter and author Jefferson Morley speaking to an audience in Washington, D.C.
So Jefferson Morley will speak first, and he'll talk about the CIA and Mossad, trade-offs in the formation of the U.S.-Israel strategic relationship. Jefferson Morley is a veteran Washington investigative reporter and the author of The Ghost, The Secret Life of CIA Spymaster James Jesus Angleton, which is flying off the shelves of our Middle East Books and More bookshelves. He'll be signing his books at 5 o'clock. His latest must-read book sheds new light on Angleton's close relationship with Israeli intelligence, citing such cases as Israel's 1967 attack on the USS Liberty and the diversion of U.S. government-owned weapons-grade uranium from Apollo PA to Israel in the 60s. A native of Minneapolis, Morley attended Yale University and worked as an editor at The New Republic, The Nation, and Spin magazine before joining The Washington Post in 1992, where he worked for 15 years. His reporting has appeared in The New York Review of Books, Reader's Digest, The New York Times Book Review, Rolling Stone, The Los Angeles Times, The American Prospect, and Salon. You are going to want to buy his book after hearing his talk. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Delinda, and thank you all for coming. Thanks to Grant for inviting me. Thank you, Gideon, Nora, and Ali, who I made friends with for the first time last night. Thank you for being my friends. This is my first time at this conference, and everybody has made me feel very welcome. Thanks to our live stream audience for paying attention. Please share this video on social media. You have your orders. Push that thumbs up button early and often. Since the publication last October of The Ghost, my biography of James Angleton, I've spoken to many people all over the country about this protean unique and some would say sinister character. But I don't think I've ever spoken to a group this large, so thank you all for coming. If you do like this talk, I hope you will buy the book. In fact, I've been told that it's an iron law of this conference that if you like the book, you are obliged to purchase the book. So I'll be signing here afterwards, and you know what to do. James Angleton's story is a story for the ages, but it's also a story of our time. And I want to emphasize that in sketching a little bit about him personally, and especially the very earliest days of the U.S.-Israeli relationship. When I started writing The Ghost in January 2015, the term the deep state was pretty much unknown publicly, save to a handful of political scientists. And when I finished the book 2 years later in the spring of 2017, I was informed by an ABC News poll that 48% of Americans agreed that there is such a thing as the deep state, which was defined as military or intelligence officials who secretly manipulate U.S. policy. I realized that Angleton, who was a cold warrior and a zealous defender of America's leadership role in the post-war world, was also an avatar of this so-called deep state. And I don't mean that in a kind of conspiratorial or spooky way. I mean that in a very specific and concrete way. Angleton embodied and shaped the CIA's operational ethos and its internal procedures, especially in the realm of counterintelligence. His theories of Soviet penetration dominated the thinking of Western intelligence agencies, and their legacy can even be seen in the counterintelligence investigation into the Trump campaign and allegations of collusion with Russia. I want to emphasize that I only use the term deep state as a colloquial shorthand term for the array of U.S. national security agencies that operate under the shroud of official secrecy. And let's not forget, there are at least a dozen such agencies based here in Washington. The CIA, with its $15 billion a year budget, is the largest. The NSA, with a budget of about $10 billion, is second largest. The Defense Intelligence Agency is about $4 billion. And then along with some other obscure but still very large agencies like the NGIA. Never heard of the NGIA? I didn't think so. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency is a $4.9 billion a year agency. Collectively, these agencies spend probably $50 to $60 billion a year, which make them a very small but powerful, potent sector in the American scheme of power. Want to know how the NGIA spent your $4.9 billion? Good luck. Want to see a line item budget of CIA activities in Africa last year? You know, move along. It's true that Congress nominally has oversight powers over these agencies. Our elected officials do have the security clearances that we don't have, so they can go in and look at selected operations. But the intelligence oversight system is very weak, as even its defenders will admit. The intelligence committees, polarized and politicized, can't even agree on what kind of secret activities they're supposed to monitor. The FISA court system is supposed to protect Americans from surveillance by their government, but it largely functions as a rubber stamp of the secret agencies. Secret government is the norm in America in 2018, which is why the discourse of the deep state has such currency today. Angleton, I'm going to put to you, was a founding father of what we call the deep state. So who was he? Born in December 1917, James Angleton grew up as the oldest son of James Hugh Angleton, a brash, self-made American businessman who moved to Milan, Italy during the Depression and made a fortune during the time of Benito Mussolini selling cash registers. Angleton attended private school in England. He went to Yale College and then to Harvard Law School. He was a precocious, good-looking young man with sophisticated manners and a literary frame of mind. As an undergraduate, he befriended his fellow expatriate Ezra Pound in Italy. Pound was the modernist poet and the mad tribune of Mussolini's fascism. In their correspondence, which I found at Yale, Angleton sometimes aped the anti-Semitic rhetoric of Ezra Pound, for example, criticizing the Jewish book merchants who he thought overcharged for Pound's books. In 1943, Angleton was recruited into the Office of Strategic Services, America's first foreign intelligence service. Stationed in Rome during and after World War II, he excelled at secret intelligence work. I tell the story in The Ghost of how he rescued several, a leading Nazi and a leading Italian fascist from post-war justice. Among other tasks, he reported on the flow of Jews escaping from Germany and heading for Palestine. The revelations of the Holocaust transformed his attitudes towards, transformed his disdain for Jews into something of sympathy. He began to develop sources among the leaders of the Jewish and Zionist organizations, including Teddy Kollek, who was a British intelligence agent, and a German operative named Arthur Peer, who later became known as Asher Ben Natan. With the passage of the National Security Act in July 1947, Angleton went to work at the CIA. The CIA came into existence, and Angleton became the chief of the Foreign Intelligence Staff with responsibility for intelligence collection operations worldwide. In those days, the CIA was right here in the heart of Washington. It's hard for people to believe now, but the CIA was located in a series of temporary buildings located along the reflecting pool next to the Lincoln Memorial. The tempos, as they were called by CIA people, were drafty in the winter, hot in the summer, and devoid of charm year-round. But this is where the Angleton worked at what was known as the Office of Special Operations. Angleton, while sympathetic to Jewish suffering, was still very wary of Israel when he started his career at the CIA. Before the 1948 war, the Jewish army had been largely armed by Czech arms manufacturers in communist Czechoslovakia. The Soviet Union was the first country to recognize the state of Israel in 1948. And Angleton initially feared that the Soviets would use Israel as a platform for injecting spies into the West. The Israelis, for their part, were looking to cultivate American friends. Stalin's anti-Semitic purges in 1948 showed that his allegiance to the Jewish state was superficial at best. In 1950, a man named Reuven Shiloah, the founder of Israel's first intelligence organization, came to Washington, and he visited the CIA, and he came away very impressed with how it was organized. He went back to Israel, and in April 1951, he created, out of a very fractious collection of security forces, what was known as the Institute for Intelligence and Special Tasks, inevitably known as Mossad, Hebrew for Institute. In 1951, Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion came to the United States and brought Shiloah with him. Ben-Gurion met privately with President Truman, and Angleton arranged for Ben-Gurion to also have lunch with his friend Alan Dulles, who would shortly become the director of the CIA. The purpose of this meeting, Ephraim Halevi, a retired director of the Mossad and a longtime friend of Angleton's, told me in an interview in Tel Aviv, The purpose was, in Halevi's words, to clarify in no uncertain terms that notwithstanding what had happened between Israel and the United States in 1948, and notwithstanding that Russia had been a key factor in Israel's survival, Israel considered itself part of the Western world and would maintain the relationship with the United States in this spirit. Shiloah stayed on in Washington to work out the arrangements with Angleton. Shiloah, according to his biographer, soon developed a special relationship, quote unquote, and Angleton became the CIA's exclusive liaison with the Mossad in 1951. Angleton returned the favor by traveling to Israel often. He was introduced to Amos Manor, chief of counterespionage for Israel's domestic security service, known as Shabak or Shin Bet. Manor headed up Operation Balsam, which was the Israelis' conduit to the Americans. Quote, they told me I had to collect information about the Soviet bloc and transmit it to them, Manor recalled about the Americans. I didn't know exactly what to do, but I had the idea of giving them material we had gathered a year earlier about the efforts of the Eastern Bloc to use Israel to bypass an American trade embargo. We edited the material and informed them that they should never ask us to identify our sources. From such arrangements, the CIA-Mossad relationship began to grow. Manor would be friends with Angleton for the rest of his life. In 1963, a man named Isser Harel was succeeded as the chief of Mossad by a military intelligence officer named Meir Amit. Amit found Angleton to be a little eccentric, but he noted that his, quote, identification with Israel was a great asset for Israel. Asher Ben Natan, Angleton's source dating back to the OSS days, was playing a key procurement role in the secret Israeli program to obtain nuclear weapons. Teddy Kollek, one of Angleton's closest contacts and friends in Washington, later became the mayor of Jerusalem. Angleton's Israeli friends, in short, were really the architects, some of the architects of the Zionist state. As I came to learn this story from talking to CIA veterans and Israelis and reading a lot, a couple of things stood out to me. First of all, the Israeli recruitment of Angleton was extremely astute. In the early 1950s, Angleton was a rising star at this new agency, the CIA, but he was not a senior figure and not even particularly powerful. The Israelis recognized the latent qualities that would make him powerful. Second, Angleton's creative intellect and his operational audacity inspired deep feelings of loyalty among the Israelis. While Angleton's counterintelligence vision would become very controversial within and bitterly divisive within the CIA, he was widely admired in Israel as a stalwart friend, and he still is to this day. In 1954, Angleton became the chief of the CIA's counterintelligence staff, the first one. In 1956, Amos Manor passed him a copy of Nikita Khrushchev's secret speech to the Soviet Communist Party, in which he criticized the cult of personality around the deceased dictator Joseph Stalin. This intelligence coup made Angleton a legend within the CIA and a power within the agency as well, and it was very much made possible by the Israelis. Angleton's formative and sometimes decisive influence on U.S. policy towards Israel can be seen in many areas, from the impotence of U.S. nuclear nonproliferation policy in the region, to Israel's triumph in the 1967 Six-Day War, to the feeble U.S. response to the attack on the Liberty, to the intelligence failure represented by the Yom Kippur War of 1973. I tell a lot of this story in The Ghost, but the story of Angleton and Israel is really so large and so profound that it probably deserves its own book. I could certainly not do justice to it in the 18 minutes that I have, so I'm going to confine myself to one narrow question about the trade-offs that became implicit in this agreement, in this arrangement between the CIA and the Mossad, and its implications for us. And the question, which was put to me by Grant, but is right on point, was, why didn't the CIA help the FBI investigate the diversion of U.S. weapons-grade material from the United States to Israel in the 1960s and 1970s? And the short answer is, because Jim Angleton didn't want to. Angleton played a key role in enabling Israel to obtain nuclear weapons, and he did so in a subtle way that characteristically left few fingerprints. He was not a man to investigate himself. Many of these details are now known, thanks to Grant Smith, Roger Mattson, John Haddon Jr., and others. I want to just give you a sense of how this transpired. So the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation, otherwise known as NUMEC, started processing highly enriched uranium in the United States in 1959. NUMEC had been created by David Lowenthal, a Zionist financier who financed the post-war boat lift from Europe to Palestine that was romanticized in the book and movie Exodus. He hired Zalman Shapiro, a brilliant young metallurgist, to run the company. At that time, the U.S. government owned all of supplies of nuclear fuel, which private companies like NUMEC were allowed to use, but ultimately had to return to the government. Within a few years, the Atomic Energy Commission noticed worrisome signs that the Apollo plant, NUMEC had a plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania, that the plant's security and accounting were very deficient. Unexplained losses did happen, of nuclear material did happen at other companies, but NUMEC's losses were proportionally much larger. By October 1965, the AEC estimated that 178 kilograms of highly enriched uranium had gone missing from the NUMEC facility. By March 1968, that figure was 267 kilograms. John Haddon was the CIA station chief in Israel from 1964 to 1967 and worked very closely with Angleton throughout this period. And he would later concur with the near unanimous assessment of CIA's nuclear scientists that Israel had indeed stolen fissile material from NUMEC and used it to build their nuclear arsenal. This story is now very well documented. In the spring of 1965, a technician working at the night shift at NUMEC went out on a loading dock for a breath of fresh air and saw an unusual sight. Zalman Shapiro was pacing on the dock while a foreman and truck driver loaded cylindrical storage containers known as stovepipes onto a flatbed truck. The technician saw a clipboard saying that the material was destined for Israel. It was highly unusual to see Dr. Shapiro in the manufacturing section of the Apollo nuclear facility, the technician said. It was unusual to see Dr. Shapiro there at night, and it was very unusual to see Dr. Shapiro so nervous. The next day, NUMEC's personnel manager visited the technician and threatened to fire him if he did not keep his mouth shut, that's a quote, concerning what it would be seen, what he had seen. It would be 15 years before the employee told the story to the FBI. What did Angleton know about NUMEC? Well, he knew that the AEC and the FBI were investigating, starting in 1965. As the Israel desk officer of the CIA, he talked about the NUMEC case with liaison agent Sam Papich, who was monitoring the investigation for the FBI. He also spoke about it with his colleague John Haddon. On the crime scene particulars, Haddon defended his former boss. Quote, any suggestion that Angleton had helped the Israelis with the NUMEC operation was totally without foundation, he told journalists Andrew and Leslie Coburn. But Haddon didn't deny that Angleton had helped the Israeli nuclear program. Why would somebody whose whole life was dedicated to fighting communism have any interest in preventing a very anti-communist nation from getting the means to defend itself, Haddon asked. The fact they stole it from us didn't worry him in the least, he went on. I suspect that in his inmost heart, he would have given it to them if they had asked. Haddon knew better than to investigate any further. I never sent anything to Angleton on this, the nuclear program, because I knew he wasn't interested, Haddon later told his son, and I knew he'd try to stop it if I did. With the fissile material diverted from NUMEC, Israel was able to construct its first nuclear weapon by 1967 and become a full-blown nuclear power by 1970. The first and still the only nuclear power in the Middle East. Angleton, it is fair to say, thought collaboration with Israel was more important than U.S. non-proliferation policy, and he believed that the results proved his point. When he started as chief of the counterintelligence staff in 1954, the State of Israel and its leaders were regarded warily in Washington, especially at the State Department. When Angleton left government service 20 years later, Israel held twice as much territory as it had in 1948. The CIA and Mossad collaborated on a daily basis, and the governments of the United States and Israel were strategic allies, knit together by expansive intelligence sharing, multi-billion dollar arms contracts, and coordinated diplomacy. Angleton's influence on U.S.-Israeli relations between 1951 and 1974 exceeded that of any Secretary of State, with the possible exception of Henry Kissinger. His influence was largely unseen by Congress, the press, other democratic institutions, and much of the CIA itself. He was empowered by his own ingenuity and the clandestine arrangements rationalized by doctrines of national security and counterintelligence. The arc of his career breathes life into the concept of the deep state. I thought of this story when I visited one of the memorials to Angleton in Israel in 2016. The memorial is located on a winding road outside the city of Mevaseret Zion, which is now really a suburb of Jerusalem. Historically, control of this high ground has been seen as key to the control of Jerusalem and of Palestine itself. And the nearby ruins of a castle built by 12th century Christian crusaders for exactly that purpose stands in mute testimony to the importance of its strategic location. The Angleton Memorial consists of a pedestal of stones topped with a black plaque to James Angleton, a friend, it says. This plaque was dedicated in 1987, a few months after Angleton died, and it has been maintained by his Israeli friends ever since. It's still in perfect condition. The location is no accident. In the course of his extraordinary career, Angleton, more than any other American, enabled the Americans to gain and hold the strategic high ground in the Middle East. He was, as his friend Meyer Amit said, the biggest Zionist of the lot. Thank you.
You have been listening to journalist and author Jefferson Morley speaking in Washington, D.C. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at wzbc.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.